So I was thinking about the fact that we as a CME group have done CME programs on PARP and breast cancer, PARP and, you know, all of these. And now we're kind of trying to bring them together in a short period of time. But we just kind of want to run through kind of the role that it's playing in these four diseases. We're going to start out talking about ovarian cancer, which, of course, has the biggest lead and, you know, really having a big, big effect in this disease right now. And in particular, four major phase three trials that have come out over the last couple of years that have really changed the way we approach this. So we're going to try to go through several aspects of this. One, the genomic profile, the genomic workup, and what the trials have showed initially in relapse disease, and more recently now in patients who have upfront treatment with either neoadjuvant therapy or debulking surgery. So a couple of questions just to kind of get warmed up. Maybe I'll see if Hope wants to answer this one, because it's an ovary patient case. So we're saying PARP inhibitors should be offered or discussed as an option phase three and four ovarian cancer in every patient, regardless of profile. Hope, what do you think?
Well, you know, my data from this comes for listening to the plenary sessions at ESMO, when we had this, you know, unbelievable plenary session with both the MONARCH data, but also the niraparib data.
Right.
Where there was a benefit in all patients. And I think that, you know, the benefit is clearly greater in patients with germline BRCA mutations or somatic mutations. But I think that there is a chance of a small benefit in all patients. So given the fact that outcome is kind of crummy in those patients, I would answer yes.
So it looks like a majority of the audience also agrees with you in that respect. We have another question, which is about veliparib. We were talking about that, and one of these trials looked at veliparib in combination with chemotherapy. And so we asked this question. So patient with stage 3 ovarian cancer, adding veliparib to induction chemo and then continuing it as maintenance results in similar outcomes to the other trials looking at, you know, other agents, specifically niraparib and olaparib. And Ursula, you kind of commented on this, the fact that maybe indirectly it's not quite as great, but it kind of seems like it's in enough of the ballpark. Do you think this is going to actually get approved, Ursula?
That's a good question. I think, you know, it may get approved, but the question is, are we going to use the drug? You know, it used a different HRD score compared to Prima and Paola, which used the HRD score of 42. This was a much lower HRD score, so trying to encompass more patients. You know, they're all high-grade serous. The issue is, you know, when patients went on the VELIA trial, because they received the PARP inhibitor with the chemotherapy, there's no kind of distillation of patients who are going to benefit the most. You know, those who are really HRD, high-grade serous, and in response to chemotherapy, which is a key component of the FDA approval for niraparib and for olaparib. It's a weaker PARP trapper. Secondly, it used a different HRD score. And then thirdly, you don't really have a way of weeding out those patients and kind of selecting them for true HRD in response to chemotherapy.
Anyhow, I skipped the question, but the audience answered it anyhow about bevacizumab, but we're going to get into that in a second. But we also conducted a survey in the last couple of weeks of 75 general medical oncologists and community-based practice. We're going to show you the results of that survey in terms of, you know, indicating kind of what people are doing. Here's one question we asked Ursa, which is, how do you approach mutation testing? Patient presents with ovarian cancer and no specific family history. And I guess what we've been hearing, and it looks like the oncologists are getting the message, Ursula, is that you need multi, for sure, germline BRCA, but I think what we're hearing more and more is BRCA is germline panels and somatic panels, somatic NGS. Ursula, it looks like that's what's happening in the community, and I think that's kind of what's happening in the investigator community.
Yeah, I think as soon as somebody walks through the door with a diagnosis of ovarian cancer, regardless of stage, family history, and histology, they should undergo genetic testing for germline with a panel test. And then at Dana-Farber, we're also doing somatic NGS as well. Yeah, and this has really been nicely detailed in the updated ASCO genetic guidelines. Panos Konstantinopoulos, one of my colleagues, was the first author, which really basically says every patient who we should be testing all these patients. It's important for informing family members so we can prevent this cancer from happening through risk-reducing surgery, and it also has an impact on treatment.
And we know in ovary, Philip, that if you just do a germline panel, you're going to miss a few patients, and if you just do NGS, you're going to miss a few patients. And just kind of curious right now, again, metastatic pancreatic cancer, Philip, in terms of workup, germline and somatic testing, same as ovary or different?
So it's clear from the NCCN guidelines and other guidelines that have been published over the last 12 months that we have to do the germline testing in every newly diagnosed patient with pancreatic cancer for the reason that some of those patients who have mutations may not have any family history. In fact, half of the mutation carrier did not have family history. In terms of the NGS, it depends. I do NGS on every single newly diagnosed patient, especially with advanced disease. But the problem is not always you can get enough tissue to do the NGS because of like final aspirates, et cetera, which are commonly done still, especially with patients, for example, with the localized disease. So in summary, we have to do germline on every patient newly diagnosed, irrespective of stage, and NGS as much as we can in patients who have advanced disease because of we had an abstract in ASCO this year. Patients who are KRAS wild type, although they represent less than 10% of the patients, but those are the patients where you can find some interesting targetable mutations, NRG, for NRG1, for example, and other mutations. So it is worth doing NGS on all patients.
Maha, how about in prostate cancer? Of course, there are a lot of reasons to consider NGS, you know, in terms of looking for all kinds of things and related immune therapy, targeted therapy, et cetera. But what would you consider, Maha, a minimum in a patient, well, let's just say castrate-resistant metastatic disease, no family history?
Basically, the NCCN guidelines and also the Philadelphia guidelines that was just published in JCO, I think this early June, the really recommendation patients who have metastatic prostate cancer should undergo testing. And the testing, I think, from my perspective, is absolutely, I do both for many reasons. From a therapeutic perspective, for me to prescribe a PARP inhibitor, I don't need it to be germline. If it is somatic and it's actionable, then that's plenty for me. The advantage from doing the germline also at the same time is obviously for counseling, genetic counseling and other family members and, you know, whether it's men or females or males in the family. So my approach is generally the combination of both. One thing I've discovered, and I don't know if this is, I would love to hear from the panelists, is that it's critical to, if you want to find out about germline as you send samples without patient consent, it may not get reported. And so you need to make sure that the patient has been consented for germline testing.
That's a very important point. Hope, what about breast cancer and where do liquid biopsies fit in?
Well, you know, it's actually an area that's being actively explored. There was an interesting presentation at ASCO this year by Nadine Tung from our Translational Breast Cancer Research Consortium, olaparib expanded, and then there's a little bit of data from the Stanford group with talazoparib looking at PARP inhibitors in patients who have alternative germline mutations. So I do agree that you need to have the germline mutation testing because patients who had a PALB2 mutation benefited very much from the use of olaparib in this group. But there's a lot of now emerging data about somatic mutations, and I know that's sort of old hat for the ovarian cancer folks, but for breast cancer where we haven't seen it as well, it seems as though we may be able to detect it more in cell-free DNA and use that as a mechanism to treat patients depending on, you know, we don't really know yet the percentage that you see in the blood and what makes sense, but there are, this is being actively explored and I think is really interesting.
So with this great faculty, we're not going to spend a lot of time going through slides from data. Check out their talks. They go through every one of these trials in detail, but really want to focus on clinical management and sort of clinical pearls from this outstanding group. But we do want to show you some of the scenarios that we posed again to these oncologists. And I think their answers, as always, are very representative of what's happening with the investigator community. So Ursula, there's like 100 different variations of these things that we present in our surveys. We just picked out a couple of them that we thought would be interesting. So one, a patient with a BRCA germline mutation who has suboptimal debulking surgery. And we flashed on that slide there about bevacizumab, but of course, one of the trials, the Paola study that you discussed in your talk that was presented at ESMO, looked at the combination of bevacizumab and olaparib. So a high-risk patient, that would be a consideration. And then you have a question of, I don't think there's much question about a PARP, but then which one? Because you have two trials where you've seen this in BRCA germline with olaparib and niraparib, different durations of therapy, incidentally, too, 2 versus 3 years. So this is what our group said. We saw a lot of Bev and olaparib in this high-risk situation, more than half of the audience. You can see there's some other answers, a little bit of use of niraparib, but I think a clear message here that at least in the community for a high-risk patient like that, they'd be thinking about not just the PARP inhibitor, but olaparib, I guess because of the trial and the indication, but also Bev. A little bit of difference about whether you give Bev just during the chemo or after. Anyhow, what do you usually do, Ursula, and what do you think about these answers?
So it's really interesting. I really reserve bevacizumab for patients who kind of have more actively growing disease, maybe have ascites and have surgery and then, you know, maybe rapidly develop and reaccumulation of their ascites. You know, GOG-218 had about a 4-month improvement in progression-free survival for the use of Bev with carboplatin paclitaxel and then using it as maintenance. It did not appear to have the BRCA carriers on that trial did not seem to have any extra benefit from bevacizumab. So I tend not to use Bev up front because it has not shown an overall survival benefit. It's a toxic drug. And it has a 4-month improvement in progression-free survival. For this patient, I would choose answer number 3, carboplatin paclitaxel, followed by olaparib for 2 years.
It's funny because as I showed that slide and asked you, I thought to myself, oh yeah, Ursula doesn't use Bev, but or doesn't use it in this situation, but a lot of other people do. The other thing I want to ask you about, Ursula, and we also ask about a situation of optimal debulking, and here, you see a lot less Bev, but still, I mean, there are a lot of people who are intrigued with the idea of including Bev. Some were even doing it before the Paola study. But what I really want to ask you about before you get into this case, Ursula, is the issue of the patient who doesn't have a BRCA germline mutation and why probably the answer to do you present a PARP inhibitor every single patient probably is yes. And you might want to comment on the niraparib study, the PRIMA study that looked at those patients, which the olaparib study didn't.
Yeah, so I so really it's important that the patient have advanced disease, so stage 3, 4, and a high-grade tumor, so high-grade serous, high-grade endometrioid, and be responsive. Their cancer should be responsive to chemotherapy. For patients who are BRCA wild type, based upon both germline as well as somatic. So, you know, for all high-grade serous, there's about a 6% incidence of somatic BRCA mutations. So it's important to do the somatic mutations as well through NGS. So I have a discussion with the patient, towards the latter half of the 6 cycles. I see how she's doing with the chemotherapy in terms of, you know, bone marrow suppression, neuropathy, et cetera, but mostly around bone marrow suppression, and then start talking to her about a PARP inhibitor in the BRCA wild type. And if the patient is on the fence, then I will use the HRD score. So I will do the myriad HRD score for those patients who are wild type to help make a decision. Although there are problems with the HRD score, just because it's not perfect, and a negative score does not mean that the patient is her cancer is HRP. So it's really to help sometimes guide patients to therapy. But yes, for a patient who's BRCA wild type, who's having a great response to chemotherapy, high-grade serous, high-grade endometrioid. I definitely talked to her about niraparib.
So I see there's some great discussion going on in the chat room. I see a couple questions about MDS. I'm not going to get into that right now in depth. Maybe we'll chat about it later, but there was a paper presented at ASCO from the SOLO2 trial that Ursula discussed in detail in her talk. So I recommend you take a look at that. But I want to kind of get to this case. I always love it when it starts out 85-year-old, particularly with this kind of therapy. So maybe you can just briefly summarize what happened with this patient that I think kind of is becoming the norm nowadays.
Yeah, so she was 85 when she was really originally diagnosed, and you can see from the bottom of the slide has some pretty significant some medical problems, and it was kind of nursing her through each of these decisions. But she went to initial laparoscopy, was found not to be an operable candidate, but an omental biopsy showed high-grade serous carcinoma. And so then she received, I gave her weekly carboplatinum and weekly paclitaxel per the ICON-8 trial, which really did not show any differences amongst how you give the carboplatin paclitaxel. And I thought this way I'd be able to really micromanage her during the treatment. Her CA5 dropped nicely after 9 weeks of weekly carbo, weekly paclitaxel. We kind of thought that she had a germline BRCA1 mutation because her one of her family members, one of her daughters, also had one. Then she went to surgery. She had an R0 debulking, so no evidence of cancer at the completion, and only finished up six more weeks of treatment because of just she was so tired. Started her full dose of olaparib, 300 twice daily in March 2019, and she's actually done quite well. And she had some mild nausea and some fatigue. She's in an assisted living, pretty high functioning assisted living right now, and really doing well. In fact, I just spoke with her this week. We did a telemedicine visit, and she's a little anemic. Her hemoglobin's around 11.5, but she's doing well. And the plan is for 2 years of olaparib and then to stop.
Any comments on the use of niraparib, particularly? I know maybe you don't necessarily want to do that all that much, Ursula, but in terms of using niraparib in patients who are BRCA wild type and the issue of treating for 3 years.
So I certainly have used niraparib in other patients. And again, I tend to use niraparib for the wild type, BRCA wild type, because it is 3 years duration. Olaparib per solo one is 2 years, and it's really, I think, trying to, you know, really maximize benefit from the PARP inhibitor, but really try to keep the risks of MDS and AML as low as possible, in addition to the other toxicities as well.
You know, I was interviewing Katie Moore yesterday and asking her about that, and she was bringing up the fact that these people who, you know, it's a tougher population when you have BRCA wild type, and maybe that's justifying using longer therapy. Well, we could talk a long time about ovarian cancer, and we have in the past, but this is, again, just a little bit of a tasting menu so we can kind of compare notes, so to speak.